Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the award-winning Brewing Podcast. Today we revisit emerging markets and do so with the CIO of emerging markets at JP Morgan, Richard Titherington. Now we've got some great content for you on both the macro and micro opportunities and threats, but before you can consume all of that, please listen first to our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation, which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Brewin Podcast. I'm Ben Guthridge, Head of Fund Research, and today we are looking at the emerging markets asset class. And our expert guest, we're delighted to welcome Richard Titherington, the CIO of Emerging Markets over at JP Morgan Asset Management. Richard, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks very much for inviting us to be here.
Well, we're delighted to have you. Let's see how you feel at the end of this intensive interview. We are, as I said, going to be talking about emerging markets. We're delighted to have you here. I think the sort of thread of the conversation will be, we'll begin with a bit of a macro conversation, the appeal of the asset class, some of the fundamental drivers and valuation conversation. And then we'll get a little bit more micro, the areas that you find most interesting. And then perhaps for our listeners, the areas that they might focus, if you haven't already covered it, the areas that they might find more interesting, such as the big tech names that are sort of so dominating emerging markets these days. So let's begin on the fundamentals of the asset class. I mean, it's hard for us to look past either the fortunes of China or the fortunes of the dollar driving the fortunes of emerging markets. I don't know where you want to start, but as a suggestion, let's go with China. There is some evidence that it's stimulating. I guess we want to understand whether you think it's of scale, whether it's enough to, on its own, to be a real buoyant factor for emerging markets.
Great, thanks, Ben. Yeah, you're right. When we think about the outlook for the emerging market asset class, those are the two key issues, China and the dollar. Because it's interesting when you think back over the last 30-odd years, everybody talks about how emerging markets, from a GDP perspective, have grown faster than developed markets. But what that actually means is that China has grown faster than developed markets over that period. The vast bulk of emerging market GDP growth has come from China. So clearly, when we think about the future, China is the biggest factor that drives that. Now, no one is expecting the next 20 years of Chinese growth to be the same as the last 30 years. Clearly, the growth rate has come down and will continue to come down as China switches from being an export kind of fixed asset orientated economy much more to a domestic consumption story. Having said that, obviously, one of the key issues that people have been very concerned about is the whole trade issue, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later on. So clearly, in 2018, the Chinese economy slowed pretty significantly, and that was a big headwind to the emerging market asset class.
The world.
And the world come to that. So, yeah, I mean, Europe got hit very hard by that. So looking out to 2019, I think there are some grounds for optimism about the outlook for the Chinese economy. And I think that for really two reasons. One is that consumer confidence and fixed asset investment got hit very hard in the second half of 2018 because of uncertainty around the whole trade dispute, which came as a big surprise to the Chinese. If we think that a trade deal gets done, then obviously you're going to see Chinese companies boosting their CapEx. You're going to see greater confidence from the consumer. So there are a lot of positives that flow through for the Chinese economy if a trade deal is done. If a trade deal is not done, my expectation is that the Chinese government will stimulate the economy. And so from my perspective, although it would be better for the global economy if a trade deal is done, because that will, you know, I think that will boost sentiment worldwide, I do think that it's highly likely that the Chinese will stimulate the domestic economy if, and to use kind of Brexit parlance, if there's no deal, then I think the Chinese will stimulate the economy in order to keep on an even keel and maintain this 6-6.5% GDP growth target that they've emphasized.
So a deal breakdown wouldn't necessarily be the, well, there might be sort of short-term market reactions. It needn't necessarily derail the emerging market growth story. I guess there are, we wouldn't want to speculate too much on where the trade deal goes, because there are different ranges, you know, from a sort of comprehensive deal to something more piecemeal. But, you know, would you sort of, I guess, share our optimism that a no deal, Brexit parlance, is avoided? There does seem to be some goodwill there.
Yeah, I think a no deal is quite unlikely. And ironically, I think that's because when we look at the US administration, the president seems to be quite sensitive to the stock market. And I think he realizes that a no deal is pretty negative for stock market sentiment. At the same time, I think the Chinese, whilst I think there are some red lines that they would not be willing to cross, but they are pretty keen to get a deal done. So given those two dynamics, my expectation is no different to the markets that I think they will do a deal. But I think you're right. If they don't do a deal, markets would sell off in the short term.
Okay, and forgive me, I'm not fully on top of the sort of the anniversary for the Chinese Communist Party, but my understanding is sort of 2020 is a big year for them, a big anniversary, so they want to have the economy firing in that sort of procession.
Yeah, it's a big year, and I think that they, you know, certainly when you look at a lot of the statements coming out of the party and coming from Xi Jinping, I think there is a recognition that they do not want the economy to slow down significantly. So hence my comment earlier on that I think they are quite likely to, in the event of a no deal, stimulate the economy.
Okay, so if we take the core view that a sort of a trade deal of some sort is arranged, what type of growth are we looking at there from China? Is it something that is resource intensive, or as you were sort of alluding to at the top of the conversation, something that's sort of increasingly more consumption led?
No, my view is very strongly that, you know, the days of China being a huge buyer of resources to fund, you know, steel plants and the car industry, et cetera, have largely gone. And my view is that the economy is very rapidly shifting towards a much more consumer orientation. I mean, you've only got to look at, you know, the growth of, we mentioned earlier on, some of the tech companies. If you look at the likes of Alibaba and Tencent, both of which are stocks that we're pretty optimistic about, you know, these companies are now huge parts of the Chinese economy. I think one statistic that your listeners might be interested in, everybody tends to think of Amazon as the biggest online commerce company in the world. The fact is that Alibaba delivers more parcels in one day than Amazon does in 6 months. And Alibaba does that in one country, and Amazon does that in 13. So the scale, Alibaba compared to Amazon is really, really
incredible.
I'd like
to say I would source that as my own, but now you've said it, which I can hardly plagiarise. But that is fascinating. Now, I want to talk about what that means more for how you're guiding investment in emerging markets later. But we'll just finish on the macro, on the dollar. Clearly a very difficult thing to call, but how are you seeing it for the year ahead? And I guess what you'd be most concerned about is a really sharp acceleration from the dollar. And is that a realistic possibility?
From an emerging market perspective, the dollar is absolutely crucial. We've discussed this in the past, and you know, I'm convinced that as the dollar goes, so goes emerging markets. So where we were in 2018 was, from many perspectives, kind of the worst of all worlds. You had the US dollar going up on the back of a strong US equity market and a robust economy, which put a lot of pressure on emerging markets. And one of the things I always say to people, that you know, you've got to remember, the emerging market asset class is a volatile asset class. It always has been, and I think it will remain that way for a long time. So if you have the opportunity to invest in a lower volatility asset class, be that dollar bonds or US dollar equities, you're gonna take that. So a rising US dollar is never good for emerging markets. Now, coming into this year, I think the consensus was that the dollar would keep going up. And to a certain extent, it has been doing against the euro and sterling. But we have seen emerging market currencies, and here the yen has, the renminbi has been leading that, have actually been strengthening against the dollar. So against the emerging market basket, the dollar has actually been coming down. So what we want to see going forward is, at the very least, a stable dollar. If the dollar weakens as it did in 2017, so if you think back to 2017, obviously, the US election went the way of Trump. Everybody was assuming that the dollar was going to be very strong on the back of that, and actually the dollar was very weak through 2017. So, of course, going into 2018, we were all thinking the dollar was going to continue to be weak, and it turned out to be very strong. So this year, we all thought the dollar was going to continue to be strong, but it actually started going down. So, yeah, the dollar is enormously important for the emerging market asset class.
I mean, for what it's worth on our side, I mean, clearly the Trump administration's embarked upon quite a budget deficit busting program, requires a lot of dollars to funding. I mean, you know, the relationship isn't one for one, but that's... it's a lot of dollar issuance, and all else equal, that might be quite negative news for the dollar. And so that's one of the reasons why we're favouring emerging markets at the moment. You're nodding, suggesting there was at least some appreciation of that that thesis. Thank you, Richard. So we'll come back to the asset class then. You talked about the volatility of the asset class. Are the valuations of this asset class looking particularly appealing relative to those that are on offer elsewhere in investment markets or relative to their own history?
Yeah. Well, we look at valuation in a couple of different ways. And the first one that we look at, which is the most simple, is just the overall price-to-book measure. So at the end of the year, price-to-book was about 1.4, 1.5. We've obviously rallied from then, so it's now about 1.6. Generally speaking, 1.5, 1.6 times price to book is consistent with, I'd say, towards average valuation. Now, average valuation means you should expect returns in the, you know, 10, 15% range over the next 2 or 3 years. So on a price to book basis, you know, the asset class looks, I think, now, after its rally at the beginning of the year, fair value. The other measure that we look at is our own proprietary research. So we do what we call an expected return analysis of all the companies in our universe, which is about 1,600 companies. We basically aggregate what is the average expected return for that universe. And let me just put that into some kind of context for you. So at the bottom of the market in 2016, if you aggregated the expected return from all the companies that we cover, you had an expected return of about 19, which is pretty high.
Yep.
Okay. By the time the asset class had re-rated, that expected return had gone down to 7 at the end of 2017. So now, at the end of 2018, we'd gone back to about 17, which again is towards the high end of its historic range. After the rally that we've had since the beginning of the year, that number has come down to about 14. So that's what that's telling you is that the average return over the next 5 years in US dollars for your average emerging market stock should be about 14% per annum. Now, obviously, in the funds, we try to have higher expected returns than that. Yep. So if you look at, you know, the Emerging Market Opportunities Fund that I run, or you look at the Emerging Market Equity Fund, the average expected return would be in the 16, 17% range.
Okay, so you're getting sort of signals that are marrying up quite neatly there with the price to book and your own internal assessment suggesting sort of 10 to 15% over. We won't hold you to it, obviously, but as a guy, you know, that's what the six. So it's not on that basis, you know, an unattractive entry point. Now, you talked about some of the funds you run. Clearly, there's a big team running lots of different mandates. So I don't know whether it's hard to nail down the areas of greatest interest at JP Morgan, or perhaps it's best to ask you what your preferred areas are. I'll let you answer the question. But what are sort of the more, not necessarily obvious, but the areas of greatest appeal within emerging markets at the moment?
Well, if you look at the global emerging market universe, I mean, I think people would have been pretty surprised at the beginning of 2018 if you'd thought that Brazil would be the best performing emerging market in 2018. So when we look at Brazil and we look at Russia, both of those markets have re-rated pretty significantly. So again, when I think in our expected return framework, the end of middle of last year, Brazil had an expected return of around 22. That's come down to 10. Russia had an expected return of similar level. That's come down to 10. So broadly speaking, I think that Latin America and EMEA look less attractive than Asia. So my preference is generally towards our more Asia-orientated funds, be that...
You know, but A-shares have rallied really
A-shares, quite significantly. A-shares have rallied significantly at the beginning of the year. Yeah, that is true.
But not to a level that makes the asset class sort of unappealing, because they were coming off quite a vicious...
Well, exactly. They come... Let me... I mean, again, I always think in terms of our expected return framework. So... When, at the end of last year, if you ranked all the large cap companies, so anything over $5 billion market cap in our universe, which is about 600 odd companies, from highest to lowest expected return, 18 of the top 25 were Chinese companies. Now, that meant you had companies with expected returns anywhere from 40 down to 25. Now, those companies have re-rated. So stock actually that I owned in my portfolio, which was incredible. As you can imagine, if you've got a 40% expected return, that means you've underperformed pretty significantly. Yeah. So I owned a thing called BOE Technologies, which was a horrible performer in 2018. Beginning of this year, it's up 75%. So, and I've reduced my position there. So you have seen big moves down. So that, let's take that as an example, because we always think in these. That had a 40% expected return, which went down to 25. So I'd say the average Chinese company whose expected return was in the 25 to 30 range, that has now come down to somewhere between 17 and 25. So yeah, they've re-rated. Alibaba, good example, one of our favorite stocks. It had an expected return of 25 at the end of the year. That's now come down to 18. So yeah, those companies have re-rated. But they're still, if you think about those numbers, so if you can buy Alibaba on a 17% expected return versus owning something in Brazil on a 10% expected return, that still makes Asia, in my view, and particularly North Asia, look pretty attractive.
Well, that is interesting. I guess I mean, it's a pretty fast moving market, but I wouldn't have thought most people would have said that Asia has a, that Alibaba has a valuation appeal over Brazilian assets. You know, let's a little bit more time on those sort of tech names and perhaps an understanding. I mean, you've already sort of highlighted a fascinating stat about the level of operation already existing at Alibaba. But, you know, is there, are these, should these should clients really be hedging themselves against these businesses sort of taking over, you know, continuing to grow at the rate that they've been enjoying? Or is there some sort of bubble formation appearing in these assets? Similar story, similar question, I guess, to those who run US assets.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any sense, certainly for the large cap names, that there's any kind of bubble forming. Okay, they trade on fairly high multiples, but they're all, you know, none of them have any debt. They're all cash flow positive. They all generate significant earnings, and when you look slightly on a broader level, and you look at people like Samsung Electronics or TSMC, I mean, these companies, you know, are very profitable and trade at relatively low multiples. So I think, you know, I think some of the Chinese internet companies, particularly these ones that are, you know, serially loss-making, are potentially, you know, bubble candidates. But I think if you look at the likes of Alibaba and Tencent, these are very serious businesses with a long growth trajectory in front of them. And they fit into this whole moving from, you know, manufacturing to the consumer.
And are you satisfied with their capital allocation decisions? I mean, some, you know, I mean, clearly Google can make some pretty spurious capital allocation decisions, but I guess there is the uncertainty in relation to Chinese businesses and Tencent and Alibaba, whether they are sort of have the invisible hand of the state making some investment decisions. Is that a risk of scale for you, or is there not enough evidence?
I wouldn't say it's the invisible hand of the state encouraging them to make investment decisions. I think the owners are quite capable of making investment decisions which perhaps don't make any sense. I mean, frankly speaking, I don't understand why Tencent owns 5% of Tesla. I don't think that makes any sense. But at the end of the day, those investments are relatively small compared to the cash generation of these companies. So I don't think this is an issue. And I know some people think, you know, that the Chinese government controls Alibaba and Tencent. You know, I think they have issues around censorship and so forth. But I do not see either Tencent or Alibaba as state-controlled entities. I think certainly when you talk to Alibaba, they have very much a private sector mindset. It's really interesting, actually, when you talk to them, because they're continually trying to reinvent the part what they call their partnership. So they have founding partners, and now they have a new level of partners below that. So yeah, they might make asset allocation or capital allocation decisions which we don't particularly like, but I'm not worried about the dead hand of the state.
Or the scale of these decisions derailing the core growth.
Think their core growth story is so strong. And particularly, I mean, we have a preference for Alibaba over Tencent because we just see it as a much more diversified business model. I mean, I think when you listen to them talk about their ability to build out across the whole kind of infrastructure platform that is the Chinese economy, it's a very impressive story.
Now, we spend a lot of time talking about tech these days. It used to be that all we did was sort of talk about Chinese banks. I mean, you do have some income mandates in your sleeve and strategies that we own.
Yeah, we do.
They tend to be a good dividend payer. Do you have much love for these names, or are there better opportunities elsewhere?
Well, I think certainly if you're an income investor, then the Chinese banks are a reasonable place to be. I think we have a pretty broad exposure from an income standpoint. So we own quite a number of China A shares as income plays. So, I mean, a lot of people, I was talking to some clients the other day who said to me, well, China A share market's nothing but a casino. And okay, there are maybe small caps which are have those kind of characteristics, but there are serious mid and large cap companies which pay, you know, serious dividends. And so that's an area that we think is very, very interesting. Looking more broadly across the universe, there are a number of dividend paying companies in China, which we think are attractive. But if you take it more broadly, I mean, I think the emerging market universe has changed a lot over certainly the 20 odd years I've been investing in it. If I told you 20 years ago that Russian companies were going to be some of the highest dividend payers in the emerging universe, people would have laughed at me because, you know, the
oligarchs. I'm very polite, but inside, mate.
Yeah, but the oligarchs were famous for not paying out dividends. But now, you know, Russian companies are some of the highest yielders in our universe and consequently very attractive from a dividend perspective.
I might just ask you a quick question on Samsung, if I may, because it does seem to feature in a lot of Asian, a lot of emerging market portfolios. And it's clearly a stock that seems to be trading on a pretty cheap multiple. But, I mean, there are some challenges, whether it's Huawei in China on the smartphones or Apple, obviously, in more developed regions. And then the memory story. You may want to sort of remind us of that, but it seems as though the memory pricing has really sort of knocked Samsung as well. Is this a stock that you think should feature large in Asian portfolios?
Samsung is a stock that, in broad terms, we're roughly neutral on. We don't have a huge overweight position. I mean, from an expected return standpoint, it looks relatively attractive. It's got a decent return in the mid-teens, but clearly it has some issues. The memory side of things has... I mean, I suppose they have really two key businesses. They have the smartphone business and the memory business. Now, the memory business, it's a cyclical business.
Yeah.
I think they have a relatively strong position compared to a number of others. And the optimists would say, look, you know, the memory market has now condensed into such a, you know, there's only four or five players globally that really... You know, it's a much more constrained market than it used to be, and consequently, they have pricing power. I'm always a bit skeptical of that about that story because I think inherently, you know, it's a cyclical industry. Smartphones side of things, yeah, again, they're struggling a bit in competing with the Huawei's of this world, who produce, you know, whatever people might say about Huawei, they produce some very, very good phones at very low prices. So. That is a problem. And I think the smartphone market has clearly peaked. And where Samsung is at a bit of a disadvantage compared to Apple. I mean, Apple's got this whole great services business that can drive growth. Samsung is a bit more vulnerable on that side of things. So, yeah, there are clearly some issues around Samsung, and it's not something that we're very overweight in. We're more or less neutral across most of our funds.
Okay, so we're sort of... I guess sort of round out maybe just a couple more questions. I guess the penultimate question would be, you know, what are you worried about for the year ahead? I know we talked about the dollar and China, but actually we're feeling quite optimistic on those fronts. Emerging markets often are very generous in delivering sort of geopolitical shocks or surprises. I guess we've got an Indian election ahead. I mean, what would you cite as the sort of bumps in the road for the rest of the year?
The things that worry me would be, we went into 2018 feeling pretty optimistic about things. I made speeches to clients saying, look, you know, don't need to worry about the dollar because it's going to continue to weaken. Don't need to worry about the trade thing because Trump isn't serious. Really, the global economy is fine. It's going to pick up. And I was wrong on, you know, essentially everything. The only thing I said in 2018 which made any sense at all was it's a volatile asset class. So, you know, that which certainly played out. So coming into 2019, should we be worried about some of those same things? Yes, there are always risks. Market's gone up a lot, in a short period of time. I worry a bit about the China A-share market because, as you say, a lot of what's driven emerging markets year to date has been China. So the A-share market's up 25%, the H-share market's up 20-odd%. I worry a bit there that if there is a positive trade deal, the market just goes crazy and then we get into some kind of bubble and the bubble could collapse. The other thing to worry about is the US going into recession. You know, our US equity people are pretty optimistic about that. But if you have a recession in the US, that would be very bad for emerging markets. So I think there are a number of things that I worry about. But if the global economy doesn't fall off a cliff, it should be the case that because emerging market earnings were so bad, disappointed so much last year, just on a year-on-year comparison, they should look better this year versus last year. If we get decent earnings growth, that should be enough to push the markets further ahead. So, you know, I think there are things to worry about, but, you know, I still would put myself in the more optimistic camp.
Okay, well, that was going to be my final question, really, about how you're assessing the year ahead for the asset class. But I think you've neatly wrapped it up there, Richard. So thanks very much for your time. I really appreciate getting you appearing on my podcast. You know, CIO of JP Morgan's Emerging Market Desk is a real honour for us. And I hope our listeners have enjoyed that. Please let us know what you think on Twitter, referencing hashtag Brewing Podcast, or leave a review on iTunes or SoundCloud, whatever medium you listen to us through. But until next time, many thanks for listening. Thank you.